I was reading when I opened from Ben-Gurion, Prophet of Fire by Dan Kurzman. I went home between festivals and read some more of this. Biographies of men that face odds, the uncommon man will do things for you. And I asked the question, how many people that read about Israel today know how close it was to not happening? Now, you know about the votes and all of that. Listen to this. Can I start over again? Tel Aviv bakes in the sultry heat of Hamsun. This is Dan Kurtzman, Ben-Gurion, Prophet of Fire. I've got to read fast. I've only got a few minutes. Tel Aviv bakes in the sultry heat of Hamsun, a merciless desert wind that seems to suggest a desire by God to test the fortitude and endurance of His chosen people, even on this day of redemption, May 14, 1948. In the Tel Aviv Museum, David Ben-Gurion, proud but apprehensive, slouches behind a battery of microphones at the center of a long cloth-covered table waiting to preside over the rebirth of the Jewish state. Beside him sit members of his first government. You know, he was born in Poland, by the way. And just below the dais, those of the first Knesset or parliament. On the wall behind him, a portrait of black-bearded Theodore Herzl, the founder of Zionism, hangs between two blue and white Zionist flags, benignly contemplating the sacred moment he had prophesied more than 50 years earlier. Ben-Gurion, his pink cheeks beaded with sweat, silently scans the semi-circular row of guests, about 350 select people, who occupy brown wooden chairs or stand pressed together in the rear and in the aisles as if physically symbolizing the divine unity of Jewry on this historic day. Palestine's two chief rabbis, sporting neatly combed beards and tall silk hats, precariously balanced on uncut locks, rub shoulders with godless kibbutzniks wearing baggy pants and open-neck shirts. Reporters with notebooks in hand gaze around the scene, wondering how they will ever capture the sublime texture of these moments on paper. Generals in khaki, without insignia, glance at watches, nervously counting the minutes until midnight, when disaster in the form of six Arab armies is expected to strike at the heart of the newly born Jewish state. Women in dark festive dresses fan themselves and stare into space, their eyes full of hope, full of fear. Many have sons and daughters at the front. The windows, draped with black cloth, are wide open, and the mirthful rhythms of celebration in the street filled are in, blending with the restless chatter of the guests, the click and grind of cameras, and the whining complaints of those who arrive late and can't find a seat. Gradually, the sounds from outside rise in jubilant noise as thousands of people clad in light-colored summer clothes gather under a hazy blue sky in front of the building on Rothschild Boulevard, waving flags, shouting, singing, humming in cadence with youngsters in shorts and sandals who have linked arm and hop around in circles to the quick beat of the aura. Automobiles honk with blasts of raucous revelry as they thread their way through the exultant throngs that surge toward the museum from every direction. Young boys and girls stand in army trucks en route to the front, waving greetings, holding ancient rifles aloft. Worried guards at the door frown at the mob. Wasn't this supposed to be a secret meeting? True, the press had announced that the ceremony would be broadcast at 4 p.m. today, but it wasn't supposed to reveal the site. For if the Arabs learned of it, they might try to drop a bomb and eradicate all the Jewish leaders in one blow. The Jewish radio, however, had inadvertently mentioned the place. So now it seems half of Tel Aviv has come to celebrate, certain that no bomb could be powerful enough to frustrate God's will. After 2,000 years of darkness and dispersion, the land of Israel would rise again from the ashes of history. But Ben-Gurion was beginning to wonder when. Like the generals, he too glances at his watch. It's now a few minutes to four, and still no declaration of independence. Now, you got to catch the drama of this. The British are leaving. The mandate is ending. The land's going to be divided. There's been no homeland for the Jews other than this mandate territory with quotas on immigration. They're fighting for the land. To the Jew, it's the same as 1776. How close? They're all gathered there. It's supposed to be a secret meeting for fear they get wiped out. There's no declaration of independence. An official was to bring it from Karen Calumet Hall, where a little earlier Ben-Gurion and his colleagues had met to put the final touches to it, but the officials had not arrived. What is delaying him? After so many centuries, how much longer must the Jewish people wait? No declaration. It wasn't easy starting a state. The Jewish leaders had, in fact, decided to declare one only 2 days earlier. You know, some people won't go to the toilet if they haven't put it on the calendar 3 months ahead of time. You realize what I just read to you? We all heard it from this side, the debates. This is the other side. Scratching out a budget of $450, they sent artist Otto Wallisch on a hurried search for the ceremonial props, and for hours he crisscrossed Tel Aviv in vain. Finally, he unearthed a portrait of Herzl in the dusty cellar of a Jewish institute, carefully wiped the soot off the great man's face. Elsewhere, he stumbled on two Zionist flags, which were so dirty that he stopped off at a laundry to get them washed. It was harder still finding a parchment scroll that could be used for the declaration. And when he did find one, he had to stay up all night testing its chemical makeup to be sure it wouldn't disintegrate for at least another 2,000 years.
The little things that make up a heroic happening. That's the point I'm making. It's obvious. You think your phone call isn't important, or your piece of the action. Even the declaration itself was a problem. Last minute bickering over its contents. You know what they went through in Philadelphia for hours? Last minute bickering over its contents left no time before the ceremony to inscribe it on the scroll. They couldn't write it on it yet. The secretary, Dorrit Rosen, rushed out and bought a cardboard binder for the type copy of the proclamation, which would be later transferred to the parchment. All they could put on the parchment were signatures, and the typewritten part would be written on it later. Meanwhile, Dorrit invited the director of a local bank to the ceremony in return for permission to deposit the signed declaration in his vault after hours. Let the bombs fall, men might die, but the declaration would prove that the state had indeed existed. Where was the declaration? Ben-Gurion could not have known that Zeef Sharif, the official who was to carry it from Karen Calumet Hall, was stranded there. Sheriff had made sure that the Zionist leaders were safely whisked away in taxis, but ironically, not one vehicle remained to take him and Dora and the declaration to the ceremony. I want you to see you know, I talk about Satan. He's very real. He has limited power, but he has power. Do you know? By the way, I will preach on a Sunday morning and prove to you by the 25-20 punishment time in Leviticus and some other dates. This had to happen in 1948. Do you know how bad the devil wanted to stop it? All these little things happening. Sound like they were trying to raise a budget. Where was the declaration? Ben-Gurion, I don't know, this half hour may be plugged into something else somewhere and nobody's heard anything that went before. Well, we're in 1948, the formation of the State of Israel. Everything's ready for the Declaration of Independence that brings it into existence. And no declaration. Where was the declaration? Ben-Gurion could not have known. Move over here. That Zeev Sharif, the official who was to carry it from Karen Calumet Hall, was stranded there. Sheriff had made sure that the Zionist leaders were safely whisked away in taxis. But ironically, not one vehicle remained to take him and Dorit to the ceremony. In desperation, Sheriff buttonholed a policeman and explained his predicament. And the policeman halted the first car that came along and asked the driver to give the pair a lift. Sorry, the man replied, but I'm rushing home to hear the Declaration of Independence on radio. Sheriff shouted a cataclysmic warning. If you don't take us to the museum, you may never hear the Declaration of Independence because it's right here. Minutes later, at exactly 3:59 p.m., Sharif stepped out of the car, dashed into the packed hall, and handed Ben-Gurion the precious document. The Jewish state would not be delayed by a single minute, after all. The birth certificate had arrived. The comically amateurish ceremonial plans reflected the improvised nature of the Jewish state itself. It was in November 1947 that the United Nations voted to end the 28-year-old British mandate in Palestine, partition the territory into two states, one Jewish, one Arab. The Jews agreed, but the Palestinian Arabs, hoping to dominate the whole area, attacked them. And even at this moment, battles were raging everywhere. Ben-Gurion, however, was far more alarmed about what would happen after midnight when the last British soldier sailed from Palestine, signaling the Arab armies poised on its borders to invade the infant state. His own commanders told him they only had a 50-50 chance of succeeding. Against those odds, why have the meeting? Why keep pushing? And down to the last minute, no Declaration of Independence. It's little foxes that spoil the vine. Why not just give it up? Don't declare the states, the United States had pleaded. Don't commit suicide. Agree to a United Nations trusteeship in Palestine. But Ben-Gurion would not listen. The United Nations had voted partition. Both Washington and Moscow, in a rare show of accord, supported a Jewish state. The world sympathized with the Holocaust survivors festering in European camps and clamoring to enter Palestine. The Arab states were still undeveloped and relatively weak. Such a propitious moment might never come again. All true leaders recognize those key moments. You don't act then, whether you're ready for it or not, it may never come again. That's that paradoxical quality of God's sovereignty and our freedom. God is forever having to reconstruct, but it'll never be the same set of elements again. Ben-Gurion saw that. Besides, the Jewish state was not simply a political issue, but a moral one for the Jews of the world. Its revival paralleled the exodus from Egypt. The conquest of the land by Joshua, the Maccabean revolt, which Hanukkah commemorates. Would history, would his people ever forgive Ben-Gurion if he now retreated before this new challenge? Through sheer willpower, he had come this far, and he was not about to let this unique opportunity slip by. He pushed, he cajoled, he threatened, and his fearful colleagues finally fell into line. The reason the church doesn't, that's what I was telling you the other night about Andre Meyer. The reason the church doesn't carve a mark on the world, it doesn't have strong leadership. Catholics are doing better right now. And the Pope knows exactly what he's doing when he goes to a Lutheran pulpit. Do you know the significance of that ecumenical move? The Pope went to a Lutheran church in Rome today. I'd follow him before I'd follow most mealy-mouthed Protestant preachers. What the church world needs is some leadership like this. Now, how should this decision that he had pushed for be enshrined for posterity? Ben-Gurion and the others wrangled over this question until 2 hours before the independence ceremony. Now, this biography of Ben-Gurion, Prophet of Fire, by Dan Kurzman, has dug into records and research the price this man paid, the love of his life. He had to choose between his work and her. He chose his work. The prices he paid, the criticisms against him, now it was coming to fruition. 2 hours before the independence, am I boring you? Everyone, it seemed, wanted to stamp his own indelible mark on this treasured document. Define the state's frontiers as drawn by the United Nations, demanded some. Then, you know, the scripture says, Judah will walk to Israel. And together back to that land. Look where he gets his cue. No! Retorted Ben-Gurion. Does the American Declaration of Independence mention borders? Come pick up a dozen, does it? Good thing it didn't. We'd have to say no to the Louisiana Purchase. We'd have to say no to Alaska. Of course not. Besides, he said, the Arabs are making war on us. If we beat them, the Jews will have additional land. Why tie ourselves down? No one had an answer, so Ben-Gurion won the argument. Another acrimonious debate followed. How would they deal with God? The believers wanted a reference to the God of Israel, the Almighty and Redeemer of Israel. The non-believers wanted to keep God out of it altogether. What about the rock of Israel? Ben-Gurion suggested rock was another word for God. And he told the Orthodox. Everybody agreed on rock. The state still had no name. Should it be called Judea? No. That was a big biblical name for a small part of Palestine. Zion? Hardly. That was the name of a mountain and could be confusing. Israel, said Ben-Gurion. Again, he prevailed. I like the old boy. My kind of guy. Now I would embark on one of the greatest gambles in history. The survivors of the Holocaust would either join the millions already dead or be the vanguard of a powerful new nation. If we had left them alone, they'd already have mopped up Lebanon. at 4 p.m., this historic day, Ben-Gurion rises. His 5'3" figure, uncomfortably resplendent in a dark suit, and as a concession to history, a black silk tie set off with a silver pin. Items that clash startlingly with his simple shirt sleeve tastes. He looked dwarfish, especially in the shadow of Herzl's enormous image. But the odd proportions of his body, with a great round head atop a stubby torso, convey the impression of a giant in miniature. His leathery lion's face, fringed with tufts of frothy white hair on either side of a shiny pate, is expressionless, reflecting his ambivalent feelings, at this critical moment when the fear of destruction vies with the joy of deliverance. Those who sign this document face the same risks the signers of the Declaration of Independence face, and there he is. I thought, Ben-Gurion said later, recalling this moment, now we are responsible for our own destiny. Coupled with this thought was the knowledge that the Arab armies were massing on our borders, ready to march across. Penetrating eyes, humorless and unfathomable, bore into the shimmer of humanity from beneath bushy white streaked brows, brown eyes that strangely seemed to dissolve into blue in certain shades of light. A thick, pocked, slightly crooked nose overlooks a pair of dour, pencil-lined lips that curve down slightly at the ends in a perpetual scowl. And Powell, take his picture again. Powerful jaws jut forward, defiant, intimidating. You know, he sounds to me like he's saying, damn the devil. And he looks like it, too. With a small and surprisingly delicate hand, Ben-Gurion picks up a walnut gavel and raps it on the table. Eretz Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people, he begins. Which means the land of Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. Ben-Gurion, in his small monotone voice, begins reading the Declaration of Independence. And the people of Palestine, almost all of them tuned to the radio station broadcasting this historic event, listen with either rage or rapture. Only Jerusalem never hears it all, for the British officered Jordanian Arab Legion, which had interrupted its bombardment of the Jewish sector of the city for afternoon tea, resumes it when cups run dry, drowning out the fateful words. Everybody else heard it. Quote, it is the self-evident right of the Jewish people to be a nation, as all other nations, in its own sovereign state. Accordingly, we meet together in solemn assembly today, and by virtue of the natural and historic right of the Jewish people and of the resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations, hereby proclaim the establishment of the Jewish state in Palestine to be called the State of Israel. Ben-Gurion then declares that British regulations limiting Jewish immigration are annulled, and the audience rising wildly applauds in acclamation. The first Prime Minister is handed a pen and signs the blank parchment on which the declaration will be inscribed later, and his colleagues then scribble their names while Moshe Sharet straightens out the curling scroll. Suddenly sounding like a blessing from heaven, the sad notes of Hatikvah, the Jewish national anthem, dripped down from a balcony where the Jewish Philharmonic Orchestra sits hidden from view. Ben-Gurion bangs his gavel on the table and declares the meeting over. And then he steps down from the dais to be swallowed up by a mob of damp-eyed well-wishers. He breaks into a child's grin and explains to a British reporter, quote, you see, we did it. How close? It was a long way from the Polish town of Płońsk, where Ben-Gurion had grown up as a boy full of heroic dreams. He had finally appeased a lifelong obsession and fulfilled the biblical prophecy of Israel's rebirth. Ben-Gurion was himself a modern prophet of fire. Quite a book. I'd get more sleep if they didn't write good books. The point of it today is how close it was to being missed, and how fragile the beginning. An uncommon man with other uncommon men and women made it happen. Yet, paradoxically, riveted into the pyramid, I'll show you, riveted into the prophecies of God to the very day God has set the time. I never understand that paradox. God's will and man's part in it. God can do it without us, but he won't. We can't do it without him. The point is obvious. It's always too soon to quit. I said earlier I'd like to, but I didn't. It's always too soon to quit. Now, it may sound strange to you, but in God's master plan, I think we stand at equally an important hour. An hour when truth must be proclaimed and nobody else is doing it. Most people would give anything now to have been standing in that room and putting their name on that document. That's hindsight. Men of vision and men of courage and men of faith seize the opportunity when it's in front of them. That's what I'm asking you to do.